I'm a bit of an unusual selection for this particular panel because Deb Darrow is like the Tsarina of prevention and research, and we all look to her for great guidance. John has been a leader in this field for many years in prevention. I'm not really particularly known in the as the prevention person. My perspective is broader than prevention versus intervention. But it gave me a chance to kind of reflect on what I could contribute to this panel. And while I think I could do variations of my normal talks, I do a lot of talks on trauma-informed systems these days, on evidence-based practice, I'll touch on those. But I really reflected, what are the challenges facing prevention right now, and where are we going in the future? And so I'm going to kind of take you back up from looking at individual models or even individual research studies and kind of talk about it from as how I see it as somebody bumped around the field for about 42 years. One is, when we talk about preventing child maltreatment, it sounds like it's a thing, something called child maltreatment. But how do you prevent something that has no single cause? It has a million faces and a million causes. And there's no common etiology that's there. So if we begin to think about preventing child abuse and child neglect, you really can't think of that as a whole. You have to begin to think of it in specific strategies and focusing down. So there's not a universal solution here. First, you have to overcome the collective denial in our society. How do you prevent something that people don't think happens in their family or in their neighborhood or in their culture? And so the first challenge is there's a public awareness aspect of prevention that accepts that it happens in, quote, nice families. It happens by people who look and act like you. In our hospital, we were internationally known since the 1970s around our work with child maltreatment. But in March 2006, I got a phone call from a police lieutenant who was informing that one of our own therapists, respiratory therapist, had been molesting kids and taking pornographic pictures and putting them on the web. And our 25-year employee, who everybody liked, turned out to be the seventh largest child pornographer in U.S. history, followed 6 weeks later by a registered nurse who was arrested for the same thing. We had to convince our staff that the people who represent a threat for a child look like us, talk like us, act like us, and you just can't tell the difference. Overcoming denial was a major issue within our institution. It's a major issue in society. So as you look at prevention, one task is how do we get people to accept that this is something that could happen, and it could happen to them at the hands of someone they otherwise know and trust, or that's a member of their family. It's not me, it's not part of my family, it's not part of my community, it's not in my culture, or what you commonly hear. The other issue is there's a whole debate, and a lot of this debate, quite frankly, happens in my house because I'm married to a 25-year law enforcement professional, Donna Pence, who is a child abuse detective. We're a marriage of child abuse. And she has these little triggers that sets her off. One is child abuse prevention. From her point of view, and I think she actually has a valid point, many times when we're talking about child abuse prevention, we're really talking about risk reduction. We're not really preventing something, we're reducing the likelihood it could happen. And so how you set up your strategy for child abuse prevention for certain forms of child abuse in certain environments is really about risk reduction and reducing the likelihood that something can happen. And where do we target it? Primary prevention, early intervention, using intervention as prevention, as you heard from TFCBT, for example. The trauma has already occurred, but it certainly has a preventive quality to it. And so as you look at child abuse prevention, there's another kind of hidden issue, which is early identification. Really figuring out how the systems are in place so our surveillance systems are able to get involved very early on to identify those risk issues and identify the likelihood that this child is at risk, and then intervening at that point. And then the other issue is child abuse often coexists with other issues, substance abuse, poverty. When do you work on the other problem in order to get a child abuse becomes kind of a key design issue. Now, there are a bunch of frames of reference about how you approach prevention. And it's a little bit like, there's no good object to pick up here, but about this. This clicker in my hand, you look at it from this point of view, it looks different than it does from here, looks different than it. You can examine child abuse prevention from different angles. But since child abuse and child neglect have many different shapes and forms, it's not even a single object we're looking at. So having several frames of reference becomes a valuable thing. One is the environmental frame. I mean, if you ask me how to prevent child maltreatment on a reservation in eastern Montana, one strategy would be figure out how to get jobs to the reservation in eastern Montana. Maybe building a road so people can get to and from employment becomes a child prevention. I mean, there are environmental things we can do that sets the frame of reference for the likelihood of abuse occurring. So you target the underlying causes, things like poverty. The public education frame we already talked about, making people aware it could happen in their environment. And a protective frame. There was a, I think it was Deb and John alluding to this, the protective factors notion. But there's a lot of play going on in child welfare around the country now about what are the protective factors. And the Children's Bureau has identified a series of things which they think help reduce the risk of abuse occurring or neglect occurring. So from a design point of view, from a prevention point of view, you can begin to target these things. Things like relational skills, things for children, self-regulation skills, problem-solving skills, positive peers, having caring adults in their world, community environment, all those things seem to help reduce the risk of abuse occurring. So if you're designing child abuse prevention programs in your community, you can begin to think, well, I may not be able to do all this, but I can really impact on relational skills because I can introduce a mentoring program. Or I can impact on positive peer programs by developing relational skills where kids can engage in activities that produce a sense of self-efficacy in a positive sort of way. Protective factors against child abuse are everything from nurturing development, knowledge of child development, which Safe Care and a number of other programs address, parental resilience, social connectedness. Families that feel connected to other people are much more likely to be able to recall on those resources when they need them. In San Diego, we have two big special populations. We have a lot of people who come across the border and often come across without having resources here. So they're isolated and alone in the community. So the risk for them goes up. We also have a lot of military families. We have Camp Pendleton, we have the 7th Fleet, we have all these military resources. But these young families move out away from their extended families and they're at risk. So how do we create social connectedness becomes an important piece. How do we create the social supports? And how do we build strong, you know, our protective families for families? The stable family relationships, helping families learn the rules, parenting some of the things, again, some of our evidence-based practices. So you can take the protective factors notion and begin to think, how would we impact on those? Now, if you're moving into away from the broad perspective, another frame of reference is this notion of evidence-based practices. You've heard a lot about it today. For us, we define evidence-based practices borrowing from really the Institute of Medicine work, goes back to a physician named Sackett, as the interaction between the best research or empirical evidence mixed with the best clinical experience and consistent with the family and client values of the people we seek to work with. And when you get the interaction of those, then you really have evidence-based practices. You have things that work, they work in the real world, and they work with the families you want to reach. Now, the decision of when that fits is a challenge. And where do you find that information? Starting with empirical, this is a resource that you heard referenced. This is the California Evidence-Based Clearinghouse. In March, we had 27,000 visitors from 130 countries. So it's used by people all over the world. The web address, I thought it was on the slide, is simple. It's CEBC, the number 4, CW.org. But it's called the California Evidence-Based Clearinghouse because California pays for it. But the information is just as useful everywhere else. And it takes in and breaks down individual programs. Here's PCIT that Mark talked about. We don't call something evidence-based or not. We rate it on a scale between 1 and 5, 1 being having the strongest empirical evidence published in peer-reviewed literature, and a 5 being dangerous. It doesn't actually works contrary to what you want. It makes things worse. And so you can basically look at a variety of topic areas, if you're looking at evidence-based practices, on this clearinghouse, whether you're looking at intervention or prevention, or working with issues of parental substance abuse or a range of other topics. The fact is, in child welfare, this is a few months ago, but we had 27 programs that were rated at that highest level. But there are 170 programs commonly used in child welfare, or for child welfare clients in mental health and social service community in general, they were unable to rate because they had no published peer-reviewed research that said it worked or it didn't. 170 programs, some of those may be great, we don't know, but they've never been tested. So one of the challenges of the next few years ahead is to increasingly test the things that we're doing to see if, in fact, they work as we think they do. So, and I'm moving fast because we're kind of short on time here. Another frame of reference is this notion of trauma-informed. We're doing a lot of work with the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration's National Child Traumatic Stress Network, which was referenced earlier by our speakers. But a trauma-informed approach to system can be woven into prevention very easily if you recognize that at least half of the people you're going to be interacting with have significant trauma histories. Then if you tailor your individual model to deal with trauma victims, you'll probably have greater success. Judy used the example of the young girl who was so accustomed to freeze in her own home that she couldn't respond to assault in the community. That young girl then becomes an adult, has her own child, and CPS knocks on the door, or community pressure, you know, something's going on in her life. Those same kind of reactive responses based on our trauma experience are still going to be playing out. So a trauma-informed system is one in which all parties involved recognize and respond to the varying impact of traumatic stress. And key phrase there is varying impact. This, if you begin to think about trauma, be trauma-informed. Not everybody reacts to it the same way. So we're not looking for a one-size-fits-all model. But we understand the varying impact of stress on children, their caregivers, their families, their extended families, their foster parents, and those who have contact with the system, a trauma-informed system, even in the preventive world, needs to recognize that the workforce is affected by dealing with the traumatic stress. There's a thing, secondary traumatic stress or vicarious trauma, that takes a toll on those people working in the field. So a trauma-informed system really understands all that in the programs and organizations within the system, infuse the knowledge, that awareness and skills into their organizational cultures, policies, and procedures. And the key phrase there is culture, that it actually is changes how the organization culture and the system culture works. And culture is basically defined as kind of what the default behavior is. When no one's looking, how do people behave? And so if we're really successful in understanding traumatic stress and weaving it into our systems, then we're going to do that in such a way that it happens whether the supervisor is standing there or not, whether there's anyone checking it or not. They act in collaboration using the best available science to facilitate support, resiliency, and recovery. So those are kind of key phrases that, from a prevention point of view, you can take that logic and apply that if you're working in a safe care environment. It wasn't designed as a trauma-informed environment, but you can pretty much guess the majority of people that we work with in safe care have a trauma history. So how would you behave differently if you recognize that behavior? How would you approach them, engage them? Because a lot of how you could use this in prevention is during the engagement phase. SAMHSA defines a trauma-informed approach, and this is more from the adult side, but introduces this notion of safety. If you have one take-home message about a trauma-informed system, it's that trauma survivors are searching for a sense of feeling safe. Not being safe, but physically feeling, emotionally feeling safe. It's called psychological safety. And everything we can do to make them feel safe will allow them to be able to focus on the other activities that are going on around them. That young woman who her father used to threaten, who would freeze, it would just shut down her ability to function and think. So a trauma-informed survivor who's triggered and emotionally dysregulated based on what happened to them in the past is not going to be participating in your parenting program. It's not going to be hearing what you're talking. It isn't going to be able to focus on the substance abuse recovery programs. And so understanding trauma and how to help people feel safe becomes very critical and important. And that extends everywhere from how your facilities are designed and operated, what the people at the front desk or on the telephone act like when clients call, all the way back to the skills of the providers. And then these next bullets really have to do with really connecting with the trauma survivor, in this case, the adult survivor of trauma, where they need transparency and trustworthy, collaboration, empowerment, voice, and choice. It's all recognizing that they need to be a party at the table. So a trauma-informed prevention program would weave in those concepts and make people feel part of it. There's great wisdom in the experiences and the insights of people who've been through the worst and are now trying to come out of the other side. You can learn a lot from them. So how to build that into the system recognizes that one, it'll help engage them, but they're going to have answers that, quite frankly, you're not going to come up without them. So there's great gain there. When I was thinking about prevention, I was struck with, there's a concept that, it's one of these things, in 42 years, you find a few paradigms that just think, that makes so much sense, and you can explain all sorts of world. This is actually a concept David Finkelhor, who's at University of New Hampshire, developed in 1984. It's called the four precondition models. If you want to try and prevent child maltreatment, you can use this model and kind of adjust it. David did it to explain sexual abuse. We actually have developed our entire response to those incidents back in 2006 in our hospital around this model. And so we were having lunch with some of the grad students and struck with, you know, these guys are the future, these bright young minds. And so you're not going to find this in a recent book because it's 20, 30 years old. But this paradigm would still work. The notion of the four precondition model for sexual abuse is four things have to be aligned. There has to be more sexual interest, motivation to engage in abuse, than there is internal inhibitors to stop you from abusing. And you have to have greater sexual interest than there are external inhibitors. And you can overcome the resistance of a child. And you're going to have, in this case, child sexual abuse. If you wanted to prevent sexual abuse from happening, one strategy, you build the internal inhibitors. That's what they do in sex offender treatment programs. How do we help that person manage their own behavior? So regardless of their impulses, how does it run into an internal stop? And if you stop and think of it, my wife Donna, who I referenced earlier, has a thing about shopping. You know, she always has a motivation to shop. So what keeps her from bankrupting us is, one is the internal inhibitors that she recognizes that I shouldn't do that. You know, we don't really need that. That's going to put us in debt. That's going to cause a problem. But when that's not enough, the external inhibitors, I'm along for the ride. There's a credit limit on the credit card. There's things that keep it from happening. So as we went to try and figure out how we're going to keep children from being sexually abused by our own staff ever again, we recognized we couldn't control the motivations of 5,000 employees. We can't see inside their mind. We don't know what they're doing. We can hope they have the internal inhibitors never to act on impulses which are going to hurt our patients. But we can't count on that. So what we can do is try and erect external inhibitors that keep someone who is inclined to molest kids from acting on it, even if they're inclined to do so. And what's the, in that situation, what's the biggest predictor of resistance? It's going to be the presence of another adult who will intervene. People who sexually abuse kids, unless they're with a known other perpetrator, do this in private. So we have a policy in our hospital now that if you pull a curtain or close a door, there's two sets of eyes there. There are always two adults in a room. We fire people if they don't do that. We take it very seriously. We have a no cell phone policy on the floor. If you're on a clinical floor, you can't have a cell phone on. Why? Because cell phone has a camera. Because Mr. Blatley's cell phone had a camera, it was posted out to thousands of pedophiles around the world. So no one. So we bit by bit put up the external inhibitors that keep someone from acting on it. And the last one in Finkelhor's model, by the way, which in our hospital we don't address, is building the victim resistance. But as a practical matter, if I were the Boy Scouts, I would be focused on building the capacity of kids to resist. Now, the same paradigm, you could take that same logic and apply it to all sorts of other child maltreatment situations. We just did in sexual abuse in our hospital. But you can kind of build anything. This was originally published in something called Finkelhor's New Theory and Research back in 1984. Regardless of what strategy, how are you going to make change? You know, John alluded to this earlier. Fixin actually had, in this document that John showed earlier, three levels of implementation. Paper, process, and performance. If you want to be evidence-based, if you want to be trauma-informed, if you want to be an effective prevention program, you can be so by the end of the day simply by putting it on your letterhead. You can declare yourself the trauma-informed agency. That's paper change. 80 to 90% of change often in our society is paper change. We change what we call it. We change the packaging, but we don't really change the behavior. Process changes when you change the policies, the procedures, the training. But for therapists, I can train them in TF-CBT, but when they go behind the therapy door and close it, it's what they do that counts. That's the performance level change. And so there's a whole emerging area of implementation science that looks, how do we create real organic change at the cultural level of organizations? And it really borrows from the trans-theoretic model of change, which is what motivational interviewing is built on. But how do you, this is the Ahrens, you heard Greg Ahrens reference earlier, he's a UCSD psychologist that we work with. How do you build that into the system? In the EPIS stage, is there's really four stages, and people often jump to implementing evidence-based practice before they figure out which is the right practice. How do you select the really correct practice? First is you ask, what are the problems you're trying to address? And then you need to ask, why do those problems exist? What you will do that will actually impact on it? In fact, there's a reference, you know, when we work with communities, we say, ask why five times. Well, why do kids come back into foster care? Well, why do people have substance abuse problems? Why do they have that? To get to the core issues. And then you look for the evidence-based practice that fits. And the fit there is not just the best science. Sometimes it's the best fit. We use SafeCare in California for our home visiting model because despite the fact that nurse home visiting, quite frankly, no offense, John, had more randomized clinical trials, it was really empirically very strong. But could I find registered nurses who spoke Spanish who would go in the rough neighborhoods in Imperial County, California? No, they can't even find enough nurses to staff their hospital. So we needed a model that would fit the workforce that had strong empirical evidence, that fit the problem we were looking at, which was child neglect. And it turns out SafeCare was the best fit for us. So it's not always who has the best research study, it's the best fit. Then you select that, and then preparing the system for change. That preparation phase is critical. It's not just about training. I think Deb talked about the fact that some of the home visiting projects didn't, you know, their caseloads weren't what you'd expect. When one large California county, we trained 12 home visitors. 6 months later, they had 10 cases between them. It's because the child welfare workers were used to referring to other people, and they don't change really. It's like turning a ship. It takes them a long time to trust some new intervention. So worrying about the referral pathways and how to build that trust becomes as important as training the home visitors in the first place. So really thinking about how you prepare the system, not just the providers, becomes a critical piece. Then actively support the implementation and the move to sustain it. So future directions. Spread what we know. 10 years ago when we started the California Evidence-Based Clearinghouse, there were things we had 20 years worth of research and no one seemed to know about it. So spread the knowledge we have. Build capacity to spread. Take it to Fidelity, or build it with Fidelity, take it to scale. Worry about the environment in which these services are delivered. But we need new models, new ideas, and we need to test those. Not just come up with new ideas, we need to clinically test them, or empirically test them, manualize them. And then there's a whole emerging area about the new neurosciences, concept of epigenetics, and how environment interacts with genetics, particularly around stress and child maltreatment. All those things shape a future that has full possibilities for trying to rid child abuse, child neglect, and change the future. In the end, I don't know how we're going to do it. I mean, I actually believe there are major solutions out there that we haven't even thought of yet. And there are more things in heaven or Horatio than your philosophies dreamt of. I don't need to know. I've been doing this for 42 years, and we've done more about child maltreatment in those 42 years than 4,000 years before that. We've made huge strides in the scale of humankind. In the next 40 years, particularly with some of the folks in this room, we have potential to do things that I haven't even dreamt of yet. And that's where the hope is. So thank you very much.